My name is Cynthia Rivera-Weisblum. I am the president of the Gould Foundation, and I will be moderating the session. The idea for this panel discussion sprung from an article in the spring 2010 issue of Philanthropy Magazine, which is right in the back for you. That article was written by Evan Sparks, the magazine's managing editor. And this article is an important and robust review of the many complex issues associated with college completion. And we welcome you to pick up a copy at the resource table. I'd like to thank Adam Meyerson and Evan Sparks and the Philanthropy Roundtable for placing college completion on the agenda both regionally and at this annual meeting. Thank you, Evan. Today, ladies and gentlemen, the statistics coming out of the recession paint a grim picture for workers without a college degree. If we are going to set ourselves on the right course, returning America to its position as the number one producer of college graduates, college completion must become an area of concentrated focus in public policy, as well as at universities and colleges, and among foundation and business leaders. There are over 1.5 million young people in America who score in the top half of their high school class that either don't go or go and don't graduate from college. These 1.5 million students come from families that make less than $85,000 per year, and they represent 75% of America. 50% come from families that make less than $50,000 per year. They are America. That being said, our nation has no systemic strategy to identify and advance this group of people to college graduation. These students represent a rich, untapped pool, and with the right support, are uniquely poised to succeed in today's knowledge economy and contribute to our global competitiveness. Our esteemed colleagues here today represent the important research, opinion, investment, and strategies that focus on college completion. We are honored to have them, and we look forward to exploring solutions. It's my pleasure to introduce each of our panelists. George Granger is Director of Research and Planning and Senior Grant Officer at the Houston Endowment, managing over $10 million in new grant commitments annually. The Houston Endowment supports initiatives in public and higher education to increase the number of students earning a valuable post-secondary credential and is especially interested in initiatives that address the challenges to success confronted by low-income students, students of color, and first-generation college goers. Mr. Granger served as the president of the George and Ann Butler Foundation, and prior to joining the Butler Foundation, Mr. Granger was a senior member of the Institutional Advancement Division at the University of Houston. He is the past member of the Conference of the Southwest Foundation's Communication Committee, the American Association of Higher Education, the Texas Environmental Grantmakers Group, and served on the National Advisory Board for the Community College Survey of Student Engagement. Thank you for joining us, George. Robert Jackson is a motivational speaker, trainer, and author of No More Excuses, Black Men Stand Up, and its accompanying workbook. Mr. Jackson speaks on various topics and has presented at high schools, colleges, and universities and conferences throughout the U.S., including the Indiana University Men and Women of Color Conference, the National Alliance of Black School Educators National Conference, the National Urban Education Conference at Central State University, and the Southern Black Student Leadership Conference at Texas A&M. He is deeply committed to his community and mentors young people in six different high schools. He is a member of the Teva Pharmaceuticals team, where he ranks in the top 9% of the sales force. He is Six Sigma certified and trains teachers, students, pharmaceutical representatives, and administrators across the nation. And we are so pleased to have you here, Robert. Mark Schneider is Vice President for New Education Initiatives at the American Institutes for Research and is visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He served as the commissioner of the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics from 2005 to 2008. Dr. Schneider researches and writes on a broad range of important education issues, including charter schools, consumer choice in education, academic outcomes, and higher education policy. He is the award-winning author of numerous scholarly books and articles, including Choosing Schools, Consumer Choice, and the Quality of American Schools. As Vice President of the New Education Initiatives at the American Institutes for Research, Dr. Schneider focuses on higher education, in particular the issue of accountability and post-secondary education. His most recent paper, published this week, entitled Finishing the First Lap, The Cost of First-Year Student Attrition in America's Four-Year College, is being discussed throughout the education community and beyond, and has received widespread media attention. Thank you for this important and startling piece of research, Dr. Schneider. We'll first hear from Dr. Schneider, followed by Mr. Granger, and move on to Mr. Jackson. Thank you.
The title of what I'm going to talk about today is called Finishing the First Lap, and it's about the cost of first-year student attrition in America's four-year colleges and universities. So basically, let's go to the next one. So why do I call this the Finishing the First Lap? Because everybody's been talking about the completion agenda for a long time now, right? How do we get students across the finish line? How do we get them to complete college? And basically what I'm talking about here is a variant of that, about the first lap. And I'll explain this in a second. Can we go, I don't have a clicker, so. So basically what we have is like for 25 years, what we've been talking about is an access agenda, right? The whole discussion for higher education was to get more and more students into colleges. And the reasons are evident, right? We really do need a higher educated and a more skilled workforce. And we know that a lot of students were not getting into colleges that should be going into colleges and that have the capacity of earning college degrees and earning that bachelor's degree and getting that sheepskin, which has enormous payoffs in the world. So the nation pushed access for a very long time, and actually, starting with the Obama administration, the whole issue of completion became the dominant issue. And basically what happened was that the Obama administration, and this happened, he announced this in his first address to a joint session of Congress in February of 2009, his first address to the Congress, he said that, the joint Congress, he said that the United States has to regain its lead as the nation in the world with the highest percentage of college-educated adults. And he's pushed on that idea several times since that speech. Others have taken up the cause, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Lumina Foundation, for example, which are the two largest foundations that drive so much of the discussion of higher education policy in the United States, have both taken up this idea, and they often talk about doubling the numbers. And this is an important concept. So the other important actor in this new completion agenda are the governors. So the National Governors Association this year is focusing on completion. And many, many governors have signed up. Of course, there'll be many new governors in about a month. But anyway, many of the existing governors have signed up for the completion agenda and pushing to better measure the retention, the progression, and the graduation of students in their higher education systems. So this whole completion agenda is becoming a really high-level policy concern across the United States. And the logic or the terms that we hear a lot about are, you know, we have to get students to cross the finish line, right? Got to get them to that degree. They have to cross the finish line. Well, it turns out that, guess what? You can't cross the finish line if you stumble in the first lap. And what my recent research is about is the cost of attrition and how many students don't get through the first lap. If you don't finish the first lap, you're not getting across the finish line. So nationwide, about 30% of students who start four-year colleges and universities, 30% of students who start in the first year of four-year colleges and universities. These are first-time students, full-time students. These are our most successful students, by the way. 30% of them don't come back for a second year. Now, about 60% will end up graduating from those colleges that they start at, which means about 40% don't ever graduate from that school. Well, if 30% drop out in year one and 40% don't graduate 6 years later, we see that it's a first-year problem as much as anything else that we have. Students, again, are failing in the first year of college. So we don't know a lot about how to limit these losses, but one of the things we do know is that they're incredibly expensive. That these losses, when students sign up for school, they enroll, the parents pack them up in the car, drive them, drop them off at the dorm, or they drive off to school by themselves or whatever, you know, and they're all out there, we're going to get the bachelor's degree. Many of them, this is the first time any of the kids in the family have gone to college, right? Within 6 months, within a year, they're home again. They failed out. So these are, I mean, there are literally millions of these stories in the nation, and they're hard and they're heartbreaking for the families. They're terrible for the kids. But what my research is about is to show, in fact, how expensive this is for the taxpayer. So we've all known how horrible this is for the individual. So the research that I'm going to show you is about how expensive it is for the taxpayer. So just look at this graph. So this graph is about state appropriations. This is every student in a public school and lots of students in private colleges and universities get some appropriations from the state legislature. And what is happening is that hundreds of millions of dollars each year in every state is going to pay for the first year education of kids that aren't coming back the next year. And if you look at the shape of that curve, you can see it's increasing in the last few years. So right now we're over $1.3 billion. The last year for which we have data, actually, $1.3 billion in state appropriations went to educate a child, a young man, a young woman who started in college in year one and didn't come back in year two. And if you look, again, you look at the slope, you look at the shape of that curve, that number is growing year over year over year. Here's another figure. Maybe there is another figure somewhere. Okay. I love technology. There it is. Okay. All right. So here. So this is state grants. I'm not even talking about loans. You know, we all know the problem with student loans and how hard those are, how expensive those are, and how many kids are having problems, and families having problems failing to pay back. These are grants. This is the federal government or state government writing essentially a check to a kid to go to school, right? And these losses are also escalating. So look at the shape of the red line, which is the federal government investment in, and this is mostly through Pell Grants. So at the end of the Bush administration, there was a major commitment to increase Pell Grants. And under the Obama administration, that commitment has increased even more. But the problem with the Pell Grants is it's like a bucket with a hole in the bottom of it. The more money we pour in, the more money comes out at the bottom. So right now we're about $400 million a year in Pell Grants that are going to first year only students, and we're up to over $300 million a year for state grants to students. If we look at the numbers over 5 years, we could start rolling up and we could start seeing some incredible expenditures. So my estimate is in the last 5 years for which we have data that ends in 2008, state appropriations over the last 5 years to students, the first-year only students, first-year dropouts, was $6.2 billion. That's with a B. $6.2 billion of state appropriations went to students who did not come back to their university for second year. $1.5 billion in federal grants, $1.4 billion in state grants. I'm going to talk about in a minute, there's some, so those are like the big taxpayer expenses. But a lot of you associated with private institutions, private colleges and universities. I'm going to show you in a minute that one of the things that they do, institutions, private institutions do, is they give out a lot of money, institutional aid, to help write down the cost of the tuition. You know, so on one hand, every year they jack tuition up higher and higher, and every year they give more and more money to write that tuition down in terms of institutional aid. But $3.8 billion in institutional grants to students in year one. Let's see, $8.4 billion in student tuition payments. So these are kids who enroll in a school, they give the school the tuition, and they don't come back the second year. So that's $8.4 billion over the last 5 years. So we're talking about serious money, families, we're talking about serious money, state taxpayers. And about 300,000 students a year, 300,000 students a year walk into a four-year degree-granting institution and they don't come back the second year. So the numbers by state can be quite incredible. So California, close to $500 million. New York, Texas, over $400 million. And there's 13 states that lost over $200 million in state appropriations on students who start in year one and don't come back for year two. And these are in states that are running out of money. You know, I don't know any state that has that kind of money to leave on the table. So let me show you the last slide. So this goes to an issue that I think you're all important people in your local community. You probably all are associated with some local private college or institution. Maybe you serve on boards of trustees. So on one hand, as citizens, I think you should know about these numbers with regard to state appropriations. As taxpayers, you need to know about these because these are serious dollars. Okay? But if you're associated with a private school, a private college, or a private institution, there's another thing that's going on that's actually incredibly expensive. So this goes back to institutional aid. So the amount of money that institutions, colleges, universities give to students increases every year. So it's up to about 10,000 on average nationwide. Institutions give back to students about $10,000 in write-downs on tuition. Of course, there's variance. Some kids don't get any. Some kids get a whole bunch. But on average, that's $10,000 a year, okay? So if we look at how many students, got that aid and don't come back, we could look. This is what this graph shows you. So every year, institutions put in more money into institutional aid, and every year, 30%, 40% of those students don't come back. So nationwide, the average private institution in the United States now spends $750,000 a year in institutional aid to students who don't come back in year two. Now, if I was a trustee of a campus, no one would ever let me do this, by the way. You could imagine why. I used to be a university faculty member. They won't let me do that anymore either, right? So if I was a trustee, I would look at numbers like this and I would say, $750,000. Can't we do better than just sort of spend this money year after year after year on students who aren't going to come back? Aren't there more intelligent investments that we could make? Can't we try to improve our retention rates so that we're just not spending all this money year after year after year after year? And I think that's if you're associated with a private university, I think those are the kinds of numbers that you need. You're all taxpayers. Many of you are wired to important legislators and governors. I think the first set of numbers are really important for you to know about and to try to get people to pay attention to. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. My name is George Granger. I'm a grant officer with Houston Endowment, as Cynthia pointed out earlier. My PowerPoint presentation is one piece of paper that's being handed out. While it's being handed out, let me tell you a little bit about Houston Endowment. Houston Endowment is a private foundation that was established by Jesse and Mary Gibbs Jones in 1937, and we are geographically restricted to the Houston area, which we call Harris County and our contiguous county. So we've got about 4 or 5 million people in our region that we focus our funding on. The foundation is a general purpose private foundation. We have 5 program areas: arts and culture, education, environment, health, and human services. So we cover a lot of territory. Education is the largest fraction of our giving. It's assigned about 25% of the annual appropriations. The foundation's worth about $1.5 billion this year. Our budget's 80, 85 million. We're going to trail down over the next few years. But so we are a fairly significant player in the philanthropic scene in the Houston area. Now that everybody has a copy of my hard copy PowerPoint, let me show you. Mark gave you all some really interesting stuff, and I took some notes, and I think what I'm going to do is just comment on a few of the things that he talked about. But first, let me show you. This is what you're looking at here. This is real data from the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. The state of Texas has pretty good data systems where we can see what's going on. I mean, we've got good K-12 and good higher ed data systems. We think this data is actually pretty good. That's pretty accurate. The story is the highlighted column is what is caught our attention some years ago. Essentially what this is this is the state of Texas's 1995 seventh graders. And if you look down at the bottom left-hand corner, you can see 1995, there were 290,000 seventh graders in the state of Texas. And this group of students was tracked through their 6 years of post-secondary. And at the end of 6 years, the coordinating board said, all right, how many of those original seventh graders received any kind of credentialing at the post-secondary level? That can be a certificate, associate's, undergraduate, graduate degree, and the like. And then they disaggregate by gender and ethnicity. As a friend of mine at the Greater Texas Foundation points out, that Texas, we have higher attrition at the post-secondary level. Well, we have more attrition, just numbers, at the post-secondary level than we do at the K-12 level. I haven't actually done the arithmetic, but he swears that it's correct. But the real story is, if you look at the highlighted column and some of the tough at-risk groups that I think everybody in this room is really going to care about, you see that our success rate or yield is not very good. The most shocking to us, a lot of us sort of intuitively know this, but if you look at the Hispanic, African-American male population, you get original class of 100 black and brown boys back in 1995, you get 7 completers out of that. So you have, what I think of is, you have 93 out of that 100 who don't have a reasonable opportunity to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. And so that's the challenge we're facing in Texas. And it's a challenge that's going to get vastly more difficult over time. Let me give you another fact that, and some in this room have heard this before. I heard Steve Murdoch, who's the former director of the U.S. Census Bureau. He's from Texas. He's back in Texas. Steve was telling me not that long ago, if you look at census data, or you look at the data, U.S. data from 2000 to 2005, and you look at the birth-death ratio, which really gives you an indication of what the future is going to look like. For all populations, excluding Hispanics, the birth-death ratio is 1.3 to 1. So we're sort of replacement. For the Hispanic population, it's 8 to 1. And if you look at the yield over here in the highlighted section of the Hispanic population, currently we're getting about a 10% yield on credentials that provide reasonable life opportunity. So at least Texas and Houston, we face a major challenge. So what are some of the things we're doing about it? Houston's focused on, Houston Endowment's focused on college completion. We think that's sort of the metric, and then you work down from there. A couple of comments on a few things that Mark said, and then let me turn it over to Robert, who actually has a far more interesting story than I do. Lumina and Gates are, Lumina started early. I think they are the ones to watch, and the higher, is, I think, very smart, higher ed givers. Gates has gotten into this game too, but, Lumina's, cranking out some good stuff. They were the originators of Achieving the Dream, which is a very substantial community college student success agenda that we, Houston Endowment's, put a lot of money in. But Gates is coming on the scene pretty quickly. There's a group that, and even the Texas governor signed on to this group called Complete College America, which is, they don't have quite as good of data as this, but they're going around and they're looking. They've got state data, sort of pipeline data. So I would focus your attention on that. I would, one of the things when Mark talks about sort of the cost of attrition, when we look at it at Houston Endowment, I mean, clearly there's a financial cost to the institutions, to the students. Part of that financial cost to the students is opportunity cost. We also think there's a terrific cost in that it documents the, that it, you know, a non-completer, you essentially documented failure. So, you know, we think that's a pretty powerful driver. And one other thing that Mark's comments really didn't dive into, but when you look at higher education enrollment, don't forget about developmental education. I mean, we get very significant numbers of students, half or more, particularly low-income students who are testing into non-credit-bearing developmental ed courses. Legislators hate these things. They think they're paying for them twice. It's a big, deep, dark hole in the community college sector. A lot of colleges, community colleges, are working on developmental ed, but we need vast improvements. Our view is that we've got, the colleges have to figure out some way to professionalize the developmental ed sequence, where you get the best, and they need the best community college faculty working with the most at-risk students. That's not the case, and very few students make it out of the developmental ed sequence. In other words, many of them can't get to the stage where they can take a credit-bearing course in key gatekeeper subject areas, math, reading, and so forth. So, anyway, a few takeaways for you all. I think what our experience in Houston is that community colleges can be a sort of a central place to do some work. There's our focus is relatively modest grants vis-a-vis the size of the institution that they use for various experimentation activities, and what we do is talk a lot to the leadership of the institutions and comment to them, try to convince them that if through experimentation, if they've discovered activities that yield higher, more beneficial student outcomes, that ultimately it becomes a leadership issue as to how do you redirect recurring resources for more towards activity that yields higher outcomes. So think of that. And let me one last item I would like to mention that can be done in a lot of places. It's not very expensive, particularly when you look at it on a per student basis, and that is working with governing boards. In Texas, our K-12 boards and our community college boards are elected. These are politicians. You get some messiness in certain places. We are funding board institutes both at the K-12 level and the community college level. I will say that the reaction from the community college board members has been fantastic. It's been quick. We, in our work that we're funding, it has really gotten a lot of these boards to turn the corner. They historically look at, we were talking earlier today, student headcount and student credit, or headcount and student credit hours. Those are what are driving budgets. I was flabbergasted to find, have virtually no real understanding as to what's happening to student retention, student graduation or completion at these community colleges. And through some of the work that we're funding, I think there's what we're seeing out of that is a far stronger commitment to monitor that sort of key success metrics at the community college level. And we think over time you need that sort of foundational piece of good governance and good governance oversight to get to ultimately improve conditions on campus. So anyway, let me turn it over to Robert, and I look forward to answering questions you might have later. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Is that better? I am my brother's keeper, and together we will rise. Say that with me. I am my brother's keeper. I am my brother's keeper, and together we will rise. Try it one more time. Greetings. My name is Robert Jackson. I'm coming all the way from Indianapolis, Indiana. Our program is based out of Toledo, Ohio. That is the first statement that we teach our young men when they come into our program. I am my brother's keeper, and together we will rise. I'm here today in the absence of our founder, Tyrone Bledsoe, who's in Houston. And my name is Robert Jackson. I'm a faculty member of SAAB, and I'm also on the advisory board. But the Student African American Brotherhood, we're saving lives and we're salvaging dreams. We have over 250 chapters across the country. We have over 5,000 young men, college-age young men in school right now, and we have 86% of our kids graduating from college. Now, I can speak on this issue because I'm one of those young men that you're talking about. I grew up in inner city, came from a single-parent home, never met my father, so trying to find my way through this process was tough. And going to college, my first day, it was difficult for me because nobody in my family had gone to college, so I couldn't say, hey, well, how was college? Or what should I do to get through it? So that's why we developed this program called the Student African American Brotherhood, so we can provide a way for young men to not just enter into school, but we want you to finish your education. So can I get the going to go to the next slide here. Thank you, sir. Great job by you both, by the way. About the founder, Tyrone Bledsoe is from Toledo, Ohio. He spent 26 years as administrator. He's a co-author of The African American Men and the College. He has published he's had other publications, and he's spoken around the U.S. and abroad in Oxford, as you can see. He's very passionate and dynamic, and one thing he always tells the kids is that he met Martin Luther King Jr. when he was 7 years old, and that really inspired him as a man, inspired him to do what he's doing today with this group called SAAB. We invest in those things we care about. Does everybody agree with that? We invest in those things that we care about. That's why this program was developed. I know we talk a lot about the statistics on black males and Latino males not finishing school and not graduating. We're on the ground level with SAAB, and we're going into these universities, we're going into these high schools, and we're working directly with these young men. Now, it's not enough for us to just come in and work with these young men. We're also teaching them how to be leaders of tomorrow. We're building them to be the leaders of this program. I'm just one person. Tyrone Bledsoe is one person, but we're trying to expand this program across the country. That means that we're going to have to develop young men to be leaders. There we go. Bad school experiences are criminatory factories for black and brown boys to go to prison. That's Mr. Bledsoe. That's his favorite quote. And the reason why we're saying that is because some of these staggering statistics here. 1 in 3 black males born in this decade will spend some time in prison. Presently, we have over 1 million black males in prison. And most of them are young black males under the age of 25. Black males aged 15 to 19 died of homicide rate at 46 times the rate of white males. My best friend was killed right next to me when I was 16 years old in my neighborhood. I buried over 45 guys I knew, watched another 45 to 50 go to prison. Young men with no hope. Studies show that black males begin to decline as early as fourth grade. So in fourth grade, they're looking at test scores and they're building more prisons. They're not building universities because they're saying, well, these kids are not going to be able to pass this test. They're going to end up dropping out of school. So we might as well go ahead and build more prisons. A few more stats. Over 70% of our young black males and Latino males have no fathers present. In inner city, 50% won't graduate. That number has gone up. 6 out of 10 black males that drop out of school end up in prison. And when released, 50% go back. It's a lack of accountability. I remember walking in the first day at Western Kentucky University. I was on scholarship, and I came in with 30 freshman football players. By the time I graduated, there were 4 of us left out of 30. I'm going to talk about that in a few because there was a lack of accountability. There was a lot of video games. I've seen a lot of drugs being done, and that a couple of those guys, or more than a couple, end up in prison. So we teach boys to be men. Because if you're growing up in inner city, or if you're growing up wherever you are, I never met my father, so nobody taught me how to be a man. So I had a mentor, a couple mentors that I had growing up, that were giving me guidance on how to be a man. We teach these young men how to be men, but we start where they are. We don't have them come in and put suits on. We say, I am my brother's keeper, and together we will rise. We want you to learn that and meditate on that, and then we build them from there. These are the images that our kids see. I was talking with a colleague earlier about how technology is taking over and about how we need to teach out of the box. I used to be a high school teacher. When I got hurt in the NFL, when I was playing with the Minnesota Vikings in the mid-90s and blew my kneecap out in training camp, that was the end of my career. I teach young men, you cannot play sports forever. I don't care how good you are or who you are. My favorite basketball player of all time, Michael Jordan. He had to hang it up. Favorite football player, even though it was before my time, were Walter Payton and Gale Sayers. Walter Payton has passed away, but he gave up his cleats before he passed, and Gale Sayers has been done playing for a long time. You have to have life after athletics, and that's another thing that we teach to our young men. The Scott Foundation is a very important foundation. Scott Foundation for Public Education tells us in a new report on time, high school graduation rate for black males in 2008 was 47%. In the other major cities, it's even lower than that, and I reference here New York City with 28% graduation rate. But we've been working with the Scott Foundation to develop statistics on some of the things that we're trying to accomplish and help us out in that aspect. So meet these 10 African-American male first-year students. Promising young men, just like we mentioned earlier. I think Mark had mentioned some of that in his presentation earlier. We get a lot of young men and young women that go into the system, go into these universities, but they don't come out with a degree. So we meet these 10 young men by their junior year. You only have 3.1 of them left. We have close to 68% of our young men dropping out of school. Why is that? Because no one's teaching them how to stay in school. They're only saying, hey, go to college, go to college. Nobody's saying, well, you need to get a degree. You can't walk away without that education. So that's one of the things that we focus on is graduation. That's our biggest goal, is to make sure these young men graduate from college. And we also teach them through discipline. We teach them how to graduate from college. So like I said earlier, in our organization and in the sessions that we have regional conferences, we have national conferences, and we also teaching these young men how to be self-sufficient. You got to stop making excuses. I mean, whatever your situation is or however you grew up, and that's what my mentor told me some years ago, he said, whatever the cards you dealt, play them. That don't mean you have to end up in that same situation. Now that I'm married with 2 kids, I've broken those chains, and I'm teaching my son and my daughter different. And we also teaching these young men how to do the same thing. So the background on Saab, national leader and program excellence. Those are some of the highlights. We want to address the educational barriers and graduate from high school and college is our number one goal. Graduate. I was talking to a young man at the airport yesterday. Said he had dropped out of school. I said, we got to get you back in school right away. I gave him my card. I gave him my number. I said, you called me. He called me this morning. I put him in touch with two people I knew in Atlanta. We're going to get him back in school. I said, if you don't graduate, you're going to end up in prison. Empower members with ethics and networks, spirit of care, and saving lives and salvaging dreams. And our program is based for African-American males and Latino males, but we're very diverse. We have some white members. We have some Native American members. So we have expanded in that aspect as well. We started in 1990 at Georgia Southwestern State University with Brother Tyrone Blesso, who's not here today. The national headquarters is in Toledo, Ohio, and I mentioned earlier that we have over 250 chapters in colleges, high schools, and middle schools across the country. SAAB is not a fraternity. And I let these young men know that right away. You're not here. We're not throwing any parties. We've had enough pity parties. Wouldn't you agree? We're here to get you through this educational process. You got plenty of time to party. We're going to help you, and we're going to provide you with the tools to get out of college and get out of high school. Okay? And we have a multi-approach, collegiate to collegiate, collegiate to high school or middle school or elementary school, and teacher to staff. It's a peer-to-peer mentorship. SAAB National, we have a national data tracking system that was created by OMG. I passed out some of these. I think you had them on your chair. If you look at page 4, there's an article entitled The Student African American Brotherhood, Building a Positive Peer Support Community. In your own time, take a look at that. But we've been working closely with OMG on this Center for Collaborative Learning and trying to build this database. And it's been funded by the Lumina Foundation. The Lumina Foundation has been very good to us. We're trying to expand in several ways, but the Lumina Foundation is one of our major funders for this. The primary purpose of OMG's is the OMG's work with SAAB is twofold. Help inform SAAB accomplishes its work with males of color to complete high school and college. Build SAAB's capacity to collect data to assess program effectiveness on an ongoing basis and evaluate SAAB's impact on college success and completion. I told you earlier that we have a graduation rate of 86%. If you go across the country and you look at most colleges and universities, it's way below that. That's why we're trying to build this program out. Because our kids do come through the program, and we don't let them leave. They check in, but they don't check out until they have that diploma in their hand. And that's what our goal is, and that's what we stick by. This is Tyrone Blesso's book, African American Men in College. Cynthia was so kind to mention one of the books I have written called No More Excuses, Black Men Stand Up, trying to give these young men a blueprint to get out of that situation. SAAB's main goal, ensuring that significantly more African-American Latino males graduate from college, period. All the other stuff, I mean, we can talk about everything else, but our main goal is to get you to graduate from college. Where are the gaps? And we hear a lot of gaps, you know. Me, myself, I almost left school my sophomore year. And I had a 3.0 GPA at the time because my family was in need of money. My college coach told me if you leave school, that would be a bad decision on your part. You're going to help your family more by staying in school. And that's what we teach our young men. You stay in school, get your education, you'll be able to provide a way for your family a lot better. SAAB is designed to empower young men of color to be leaders who become contributing citizens who make a difference. We don't just want, when you graduate from college, we're not done. We keep up. We stay in contact with you. We want you to come back to this program. I can't do this forever. Tyrone Blesso can't do this forever. We need you to step in. So we bring these young men into one location 3, 4, 5 times a year, and we train these young men on how to speak. We train them on how to educate each other, educate their peers, and younger men that come behind them. And we also train them how to be speakers because we have national conferences. So our young men, we teach them how to be self-sufficient and how to run the program themselves. I told you about the diversity in SAAB. We have a lot of Native Americans. We have some white SAAB members. We have Latino. We have African-American males. We don't turn away anybody. They want to come into the program, we let them in. And we have some white members come and say, well, we'd like to be a part of it too. We let them in. And if you look at the brochure I passed out with Dan here, Dan is one of our members. Dan is at North Central College, and he's one of the members of SOB. SOB believes members want to care, members want to be a part of something big, and members want to feel a sense of belonging and inclusion. Members want to go on a meaningful journey. Members want to be leaders who make a difference. Those are all the things that I wanted as a college student when I walked on that campus, but I was clueless about a lot of things that I wasn't taught as a young man. Growing up in my neighborhood, nobody went to college. So how are we expecting these young men to understand what the college experience is? That's what we're teaching them through SOB. SOB is building blocks, a culture of hope, a culture of love and acceptance, a culture of intentionality, a culture of accountability, and a culture of success. You graduate from college, you're going to be successful. You got to speak it into existence. So we teach them how to do that. The SOB experience, we create a culture, we shape values, we form beliefs, and we transform behaviors. So when these young men walk in, we take them as they are. Because we're going to create a culture, then we shape their values, and after we shape their values, they start forming beliefs. Well, Mr. Jackson, can you teach me how to tie a tie? Nobody taught me that. Not only am I going to teach you how to tie this tie, I'm going to give it to you. And every time we have an event, I'm going to give you a suit, I'm going to give you shoes, I'm going to give you a belt, whatever you need, I'm going to equip you with the things that you need to be successful. So that transforms behaviors after we do that. So that's what SOB is all about. We try to create a culture, we shape values, and we form beliefs that's going to transform behaviors. This is our SOB National Conference. We did it last year in Indianapolis, Indiana. We had over 600 young men at this conference last year. Over 600 young men, and we're trying to get the numbers to go up from there. SOB National Headquarters, I told you, is in Toledo, Ohio. And right now we have 250 chapters, as I mentioned before, but we're trying to expand that as we speak. We're putting some tracking systems in place, and we're trying to crunch some numbers so we can get more chapters going across the country. Okay, and I guess I will answer a few questions later. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Your combination of insightful comments, experiences, really gives us a perspective to understand how we can address the issue of college completion. Prior to our discussion, I was asked to share some information on one of the Gould Foundation's grantees. Let me first state that we at the Gould Foundation feel strongly that there are real solutions to America's educational challenges that lie outside the walls of our nation's most underperforming schools. And Mr. Jackson, your program is an example of one of them. Schools are obviously critical to success, and we hold great hopes for the current reform movement and its impact over time. There are, though, successful programs operating now, today, outside and alongside our neediest schools. These programs have the discipline, the focus, and the academic rigor necessary to lift students from underserved schools into college and on to graduation. Sponsors for Educational Opportunity, or SEO, is a leading example of one of these programs. SEO primarily serves Black and Latino students, and their hallmark is academic rigor. SEO zeroes in on the untapped, motivated middle, the large numbers of lower-income students who regularly attend school, earn average classroom grades, but are not receiving an education that prepares them for college admission and graduation. Most importantly, while these students earn average grades at our nation's underperforming high schools, when tested upon entry to an SEO program, they perform only in the 30th percentile on their entrance exams. Upon graduation, however, they score in the 60th percentile. The most stunning evaluation that the Gould Foundation has done in regard to Sponsors for Educational Opportunity surrounds the SAT scores, and I'll be sharing and passing out some information. Students in the SEO program who come from families whose median income is $41,000 per year, upon completion of the SEO program, score on the SATs on par with students whose family's median income is $110,000. We thought a short video on SEO could capture the essence of the program.
I think that in most cases, success comes from individual ability and somebody out there who is guiding a young person, somebody who wants to make that young person a success.
A recent study shows that academic preparation in high school is by far the greatest contributor to academic success in college and college graduation. The goal of the SEO Scholars Program is to identify average performing, motivated public high school students. As part of its Achievement Gap initiative, the Scholars Program has developed a rigorous college prep curriculum that emphasizes intense academic preparation. This curriculum consists of more than 200 classroom hours per year devoted to critical reading, critical writing, vocabulary, grammar, and math. All SEO scholars attend our Saturday Academy, essentially adding a sixth day to the school week. Scholars also participate in study skills workshops, college campus visits, mentoring programs.
Being an inner city public high school student, the quality of education is not the same. And if we're college bound, then there's definitely going to be a gap. SEO provides a bridge.
This preparation increases SAT scores, improves admission to colleges, strengthens their academic performance in college, and ensures timely graduation. Most importantly, SEO has virtually eliminated the academic achievement gap. Upon completion of the program, Black SEO seniors outperform white college-bound seniors nationally on the SAT exam.
SEO pushed me further than what my high school was accepting. SEO wants you to know that there's other competitors out there in the world and other schools.
Our kids are no longer competing against each other. They're competing against kids in India and China. And so we need international standards, and we have to hold teachers and students and parents accountable for performance. And until we start doing that, we can't begin to have a system of excellence in the United States.
SEO has taken a lead in finding these youngsters, preparing them to excel, and then moving them into the competition for colleges.
I think I'm more focused than the kids in my school, just because they don't really see the importance of going into a really great college and thinking about your future.
The SEO Scholars Program doesn't just prepare students for college admission. We provide services and support throughout their time in college, an 8-year span beginning in ninth grade through college graduation.
What we are proving is that with a certain amount of academic intervention, encouragement, and coaching, they can do exceedingly well.
SEO doesn't just teach you about academics. They teach you about how to be a successful individual.
It's just like a light at the end of the tunnel, and that's what you strive for. That's what SEO gives you. It gives you that hope. You put in an extra amount of effort right now, and it just pays off later in life.
My future, to me, it looks good.
They start to think of themselves as part of something larger than themselves, and that is a very powerful idea.
SEO is about opening up eyes to a new world.
A lot of the things that I want from life, I've learned through SEO.
SEO really taught me that you just gotta go for opportunities.
They just become like your family.
It was honestly the best experience I've ever had in my life.
It makes me see my future clearly.
Sponsors for educational opportunity. Opportunity. The last word.